It's a pleasure to be with you this weekend. Again, my name is Daniel Hendricks, and I'm a Jesuit priest living in New York City. I've been there for 4 or 5 years now. I'm working on my PhD at Columbia University. I think this will be my final year, and then the Jesuits will find a place to put me for a teaching assignment and such. I was here in this parish in the summer of 2004, and I'd come from a motorcycle trip that I'd been enjoying with my father in South Dakota and Nebraska, which in those years we had been doing for a number of summers. And I had a spill on the motorcycle, and then we had to take care of that, and I flew here for a wedding. So last time I was here in your parish, I was in great pain. So I feel much better today. Your space is such a beautiful worship area. I remember it well. I was here for the wedding mass of Zachary and Barbara Jajitz, who live close to here, and I was here last night with them to baptize their twins at the 7:15 mass. So in organizing that, Father Dick said, well, why don't you just take all the masses? But I'm very happy to do that. I would like just to comment for a few minutes on these readings, and to do so, I turn to a Catholic philosopher. And in my estimate, he would be and is the most important, most well-known, significant philosophers today. People are really dealing with his work. His name is Charles Taylor. Now, he's not to be confused. If you watch news and such, he's not to be confused with the warlord of Liberia, who is under criminal trials and such of the same name. When I tell people about Charles Taylor, they Google Charles Taylor and find him and not the Catholic philosopher. The Taylor I like is from Montreal, and for many years he's been associated with McGill University. And he wrote a book in 2007, his magnum opus. And the book is called A Secular Age. And it goes on and on and on. It's 900 pages. And he says, I have a story to tell about the way we live our lives in a secular world. Now, what he means is communities like ours, in the United States, Canada, Scandinavia, Western Europe. He says these places, many years ago, were densely and thickly religious communities. In fact, not being religious or spiritual would have been the strange option. And he says in many ways, now it's just the reverse. Now, the United States is different on that, but at least for Western Europe and those countries, to be religious really is the alternative. So he says this, he says, the reason this has happened is not the reason we hear about from the popular writers who endorse atheism or different expressions of agnosticism. He says the story is much more fascinating, much more intricate and complex. And he says in many ways, Christianity, not exclusively, but Christianity itself is at fault for some of the problems that has brought about a secular world. So one of the things he's interested in is this. He says, we don't have religious experience. Or if we do, we don't admit it. Or if we admit it, we don't dwell on it and let it teach us something. So he said, we really are impacted by God. God is trying to get our attention. Always. And in a secular age, we've learned to block God, to prevent that from happening, to disregard the work of grace at work in the world around us, at work in communities, at work in our own hearts. So he said, we have to find a new way to let the work of God, the work of heaven, the supernatural, impact our lives. So the term he uses to do this, he said, we need to experience dimensions of fullness, the fullness of life. We're less complete in a secular age because we've lost some of these things about what it means to be human. One of the ways, he has many ways of trying to demonstrate what fullness is, what it looks like, how it might feel. But one of the ways is through reconciliation. So at the end of this big, long book, in its 19th or 20th chapter, page like 850, he talks about forgiveness and reconciliation. He says this is also one of the ways of experiencing the work of God at work in the world around us and with us. But we have to enact it. We participate in God's life when we exact reconciliation and forgiveness. We act as if God would act. So he turns to someone like Nelson Mandela, and he gives this great description of the Peace and Reconciliation Commission of South Africa. And he said, who could forget, who could disregard the atrocities of apartheid? It's not something you just turn your back on. But to try and get reparations and exact justice for such atrocities, what do? Forgive. Move on. Tell the story, but move on. Well, the readings today, each of them in their own way, I think deal with a dimension of reconciliation and of bringing community together, bringing people together. The gospel ends with that great image of two or three gathered in God's name to pray, and the community which is established, and the work of grace there present. Think for a minute of the story of Genesis and the lack of reconciliation present with the first fault, the first sin. Adam and Eve make a mistake. So what do? They hide from God. One of them blames the other. They're evicted from the land where they live, their dwelling, their environment. And then they're forced in a new land to labor upon it for it to produce something to sustain them. And then they look at themselves individually, and they're embarrassed and ashamed in their nakedness. So they cover themselves, they clothe themselves. Relationship broken with God, with each other, with their land, with their own sense of self. And God wants to restore relationship. God wants people coming together. And I think the readings today intensify a spotlight upon the way we relate, that second dimension of Adam and Eve when they start blaming each other. I think that's what the readings today are focusing upon, and the ways we can reconcile with one another. So when we get to the gospel, it says, here's strategy number one to reconcile you to her or him. And if that doesn't work, here's another strategy. And if that doesn't work, try this. And then try this. Keep trying. I think that's the point. Reconciliation. So I thought last night when I was here at 7:15 and we were baptizing Kip and Ivy, the twins of Zachary and Barbara, it was so wonderful that two young, beautiful persons came into this community. Because reconciliation is about community and the growth of community and being with one another, and it extends throughout this parish and the city and well beyond. So the question, where is reconciliation necessary for any of us? In family or friends, at the workplace, in the city? It'll be an important message next week in New York City, where I live. But not just New York City, in the nation, as we deal with 9/11. And just in the years past, the terrible, awful feelings about other religious communities who are trying to set up practice and life around the disaster sites and the prejudices and the hatred. So reconciliation and forgiveness is not easy. Where, for any of us, is one more step of reconciliation necessary? How does God invite that today?